Hello, my name is Jim Judges. I'm a senior academic technologist at the University of Warwick, and this is the first in a series of upcoming podcasts from the Learning Design Consultancy Unit, LDCU. These short recordings are designed to share experiences of staff from across the university who are involved in designing and adapting teaching and learning for online delivery. And there's quite a lot of that going on at the moment. There are three sections to this first podcast. In the first interview, I'm joined by Mo Moini, an MSc programme course director and assistant professor in the Warwick Business School. And he talks to us about some of his recent experiences moving to online delivery in the third and final term of the last academic year, as well as sharing some useful tips and ideas related to online learning. This is followed by a conversation with Alan Dolan, Associate Professor and Director of Social Work from the Warwick Centre for Lifelong Learning, CLL. He shares some of his own experiences getting to grips with technology and the processes involved as he and his team embark on this new mode of delivery. The podcast is rounded off with some highlights from a recent open discussion with LDCU colleagues Jess Humphreys, Jenny Mills and Robert O'Toole, who are joined by Nick Bullen from Life Sciences to discuss some practical tips on including students in the process of co-design. Good afternoon. I'm with Mo Moini from Warwick Business School, WBS, here at the University of Warwick. Rather than me introduce Mo, I think probably best to let you introduce yourself. Could you tell us about where you work and your role and maybe say something about your previous work experience, Mo?
Thanks very much, Jim, for having me on the podcast. It is a great initiative. About myself, I'm the course director for an MSc program at WBS. I'm also an assistant professor in information systems. At the same time, from time to time, I teach at Lancaster University Management School, and actually during the pandemic, I taught at both universities, so I have seen a few work environments over the past month. And before joining Warwick, I was a senior lecturer at the University of Sussex.
Thanks, Mo. Can you say something about how you found the move to online delivery at Warwick, and perhaps what's worked well and what have been the challenges?
Sure. Well, I can speak about WBS, but perhaps not the entire university's move to the online environment.
Yes.
I think the pandemic has surprised many organizations around the globe and forced them, if they were not online before, forced them to do turnkey, rapid digital transformations, right? But I would say at WBS, we were having a nice, smooth transition to online teaching last term in term three, given the circumstances. And I think that's luckily because WBS has been offering a distance learning MBA for many years, and the technology platform, core processes, and brilliant supporting staff members were there, the experience was there. So the challenge was for a teacher like me to move a face-to-face module in terms of the content and the activities and everything using the existing, you know, platforms. So we had to make these seminars online friendly. And then also another challenge was bringing face-to-face students to the mindset of online participation and engagement.
Thanks for that. And can you say a little bit about how you approached that and how you managed to coax your students perhaps into that mode of delivery and make that switch?
Well, it was not easy. Actually, there were a few things that didn't work well at the beginning when I did make that switch. Just to give you an example, so we had to create asynchronous content. And I was pre-recording some of the lectures, and then in the live sessions, in the seminars, I was assuming that the students have engaged with those pre-recorded materials and come to the live sessions prepared for doing related activities. Yeah. And early on, I was surprised to see the number of students who, for different reasons, and some of them legitimate reasons, have not engaged with the asynchronous materials at all. And in a sense, they are not prepared to do live session activities, or they are not motivated to interact and engage. So I, on this spot, with the help of a colleague who was observing my teaching at the same time, we came up with a couple of solutions. We converted some of the activities to group discussions and group work. So we divided the time during each live session to group work and then sharing it back with the class. And we use technology, a virtual workspace for students so that they can meet up in smaller teams.
Yes.
Right? Teams of four or five yes. students, and then they would be more willing to engage. We had a shared workspace, a shared PowerPoint file in which students could write their contributions instead of talking about it. And for many of these students, this was the preferred mode of engagement. They would write, but they wouldn't be really willing to present it, right?
Yes.
And that significantly increased the engagement. And a timed use of the chat box on the platform that we were using, right? Just a simple chat box, but using it for the predefined purpose. So I would pose a question, and then that would be the time for the students to answer, right? Not throughout the rest of the lecture and so on. A timed use of the chat box for a pre-specified purpose worked well as well.
Out of interest, technology-wise, what method did you use for actually recording your content?
Oh, for my own content, I used PowerPoint.
And you record audio and maybe video into your PowerPoint?
So at the beginning, I was trying to have my talking head on the first slide, but then I found it distracting myself, so it's audio only.
Yeah.
But when I watch videos and learning myself on YouTube, I prefer to see the talking head. I think it's a matter of self-image and not liking to see myself looking at the ceiling of my room when I'm thinking.
Yes. Was there anything else that perhaps you wanted to do but couldn't, or anything else that didn't work that you had to adjust or change?
Sure. Let me give you one example. I think at the beginning, I was targeting each pre-recorded video to be maximum 10 minutes or 12 minutes, right? We, as human beings, we have a limited attention span, and anything beyond that, especially when you're explaining deep theoretical concepts, it might be very difficult to, you know, stay attentive throughout that. And I think I was enjoying myself too much in some of the recordings, and it went beyond that when I was recording them. And it wasn't an issue for then, but I think now I'm thinking about making the videos a little bit more interactive. Oh. For example, using HTML5. And if that's not possible, at least asking your students to pause the video, scan a QR code, or go and do this activity, or go and have a look at this specific site.
Yes.
Or look at this specific reading and come back and watch the rest.
Yes.
So in a sense, introducing some natural pauses
Yes.
in a video, if the video needs to be long in order to cover the concepts.
That's good. Yes, I've heard of a few folks thinking about that and doing that, building interactivity, which I think is possible in H5P and also Echo 360, I believe. And I think sometimes with video content, that if all you do is say, before I reveal the definition for this, stop the video and think for a few moments about what your ideas are related to this concept, you know, so you could even do that, can't you? And some students may well take up the opportunity. I think you're right, building in those breaks and links to other activities or pauses are good. So can I ask you then about how things are looking for delivery for this coming academic year, and perhaps what stage you're at in preparation for that, and even perhaps what you're looking forward to or maybe have some concerns about? So quite a big question, but how are things looking for your delivery for this year?
Sure. Well, it's no secret that there's a lot of uncertainty because of the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
But I would say that things are looking good, because we are basing our plans on flexibility, and we are trying to be ready for a diverse range of likely scenarios, in the sense of being there, but not being there, being half of the time there, and then some of the other students not being there, and so on. So there's a lot of combinations of scenarios that would be possible for this coming term, and we are trying to find the common denominator between them and staying flexible in the lectures and seminars. As course director, these days I'm busy with working with my colleagues and managing the drip feed of students who will join late throughout the term. So we have students who are already on campus, we have students coming in week one, week two, and so on until week 11, and then we have students who are coming even later during term two. And that would mean that flexibility that I was talking about, it needs to be so much that we can accommodate the learning experience of all of them.
WBS are very used to working with students from all around the world, of course, and already have some experience in some of what you're talking about. But the scale of what you're doing must be a challenge. I'm interested in if you can say anything about how you're managing to perhaps deliver content to students in different time zones, in different parts of the world, and even where possibly there might be some restrictions on accessing content. Has that caused any problems?
Yes, in terms of restrictions of access from certain countries, we have been actively looking for whether the tools that we are using would be, you know, equally accessible in most countries around the globe. In terms of the difference in time zones, what the program team at WBS has been doing is that they're trying to conduct the timetabling of the online seminars for the morning sessions, so that most of these students are in a time zone that the morning sessions would be more appropriate for them. And then the face-to-face sessions are scheduled mostly for the afternoon ones.
So thank you for that. Mo, as you prepare for the new academic year, can you say anything about any difficulties or barriers that you have faced and how they are being overcome?
Sure. It would be a cliche if I just say that the amount of uncertainty, the uncomfortable uncertainty introduced by the pandemic, would be the major barrier. So instead, the point I want to make is about the digital divide created by the amount of use of technology. So research in my field, information systems, shows that extensive use of technology pronounces the digital divide for everyone. And in our case, it means students, but also faculty members and professional staff members. The more we rely on technology, the more it means that we have to watch offering equal opportunities and also support for all the parties involved. Just to give you an example, it takes a lot of time for a faculty member like myself, who is using a new technology for teaching, to get comfortable with it and to develop the confidence, the self-efficacy of using it, while my main focus is on the content of a session rather than being distracted by the logistics of running the technology. Where should I click? Where should I put things? How can I diagnose problems? What is the plan B if something crashes, and so on? And I think this takes more than attending some training sessions. Because training sessions are good, you will learn about some features and functionalities and click patterns, but developing that confidence, it's a matter of building a skill, and a skill development needs time. So what we are doing right now in our group is we are trying to cope with this by enabling some sandboxing and also some dry runs before the term begins, so that the faculty members can come and, you know, try a few things at the presence of their colleagues and other, you know, support staff, so that they kind of warm up for the term.
This is good advice and great comments and ideas to reflect on there, Mo, because I think it is worth remembering, isn't it, that the technology has been with us for a while, and many of us have maybe used some of this technology in different ways, but the fact that we're now having to use this technology to deliver content, either live or in a recorded manner, does mean that there are new challenges and anxieties and practice means not just that maybe it will get better, but also that those anxieties are reduced and that confidence is developed. Does that mean your staff are delivering some live sessions to each other, or what form does that sandbox take?
Sure. The way I did it in Term 3 for myself was, because it was one of the first time I was delivering online, I used multiple devices at home, and I created a little classroom using Teams for myself, using some different email addresses, and I got connected to the same Teams with different devices that I had. So I created a little classroom, I think with 5 fake students, and then I tried to practice all of the features and functionalities, and then went to the other devices and responded as if I was a student. So without the need to rely on anyone else, I could actually create a little sandbox environment and try a few things and actually try to crash software.
Great. I like it. Yeah. So grab some spare devices and become your own students and have a play.
Exactly. Which is always... One of the cameras was facing the side of my face, the view angle that yes. I prefer not to see anymore.
Oh, well, no comments. I know the feeling. Could I ask you, Mo, if you had one tip or perhaps some general advice for staff who are maybe not quite as far ahead or might not have as much experience as yourself and new to this mode of delivery, what would that advice be?
Sure. Over the past few months during the pandemic, I've prepared three different modules and I've delivered three different modules. And I certainly have one advice. And that advice is record your videos only once and save your time and energy by resisting the temptation to record again. It's perfect in the first take. And if there are any hiccups, well, your students will understand. Don't worry.
Yes, thank you for that. There's good advice there. Good is usually good enough. Thank you. Thanks for your time this afternoon, Mo, and good luck with your work in the coming academic year.
Thanks again, Jim, and all the best to everyone teaching this year.
Thank you very much. Goodbye. I'm here with Alan Dolan from the Centre for Lifelong Learning, CLL, at the University of Warwick. Rather than introduce you, Alan, could you introduce yourself and say a little bit about your work at Warwick and your background?
Sure. So I am the Director of Social Work in the Centre for Lifelong Learning. I've currently been in the Director of Social Work for about 5 years now. Previous to that, I spent 15 plus years in the medical school where I was before, and so I'm not a social worker. I'm a medical sociologist by trade.
And can you say something about your current role?
So the current programs we have an MA in social work that we are just teaching out. Our main program is the degree apprenticeship in social work, which is a relatively new degree program. We have our cohorts of different students have got to the end of their first year and are just about to start their second year. And we have some new cohorts who are just entering their first year.
And what sort of scale are you operating at? How many students do you have in total on this?
So we have just over 100 apprentices on the degree apprenticeship. We have a number of partners from who we are working with, and we teach both on-site, which is on campus, and we also teach off-site. We go to two localities to deliver the degree apprenticeship. It's a day release program. So they are 4 days of the week. They are employed by their employer, local authority in the main. And then 1 day a week, they come to the university for the full day of teaching.
So, how's that going? And what's your delivery model like?
So we are using Teams for the live delivery. So that's the reflective work, the small group work, seminar type work. And we are using Moodle recorded lectures for the lecture material that we pre-record and build that into the day.
And what's the feedback from the student? How are they adapting to this mode of delivery? Have you got any feedback on this asynchronous recorded content?
Yes. I mean, we've only had the starts. So we had inductions a week or so ago, and they were all live via Teams. So they've only just begun to have the recorded lectures. So far, touching wood, they seem to be well received. They seem to like the fact that they can go back and check things and pause. Hopefully they will find that as a useful resource. They will be able to ask questions from the lectures within the small group work. Yeah. So it appears to be working well at the moment.
And can I ask what size groups you have? And even, I appreciate perhaps you haven't started your live teaching sessions yet, but what size groups you have and how the day might be structured for the live sessions?
Yeah. So we have a full day and they start at 9 and go through till 4:30. So it's a long day, and we have combinations of both. So we have some welcome and reflective work early on, and then we have they have access to the video for the lecture. And then we'll have small group work as we would normally have, with pieces of work for them to look at. And then the same again in the afternoon, more lectures and reflective work for them. So, and they appear, I mean, they at the moment it's early days, but it touching wood again, it seems to be going well.
Yes, and that's that sounds good. And in terms of your own preparation then to online delivery and preparing content, you've had to record your lectures and upload content onto Moodle. How have you found that process?
Yes, I mean, it's taken a little bit of work. I haven't done it before, so I'm using PowerPoint as to record my sessions and then upload to Stream, and then upload again then to Moodle when the time comes. My first substantive teaching is next week, so I'll let you know how I get on.
Can I just ask you about that? So you're recording slide by slide your audio. Do you include your video in that? Sometimes tutors do, sometimes they don't. It depends on the version. Do you do that at the moment or not?
I made a decision that I wouldn't include the video, simply because I think it can be slightly distracting. I'm not giving, in my view, because there wasn't any interaction at that point, I think I'd rather them listen to my and get the transcript and not be put off by me in the corner looking at them, so to speak.
Yes. No, that's fair enough. And that can depend on personal preference. And I know sometimes people do, sometimes don't, and sometimes a mix of both. And then am I right in thinking when you finish that recording and you export that as an MP4, a video, is that right? And then what
yes.
do you do with that?
So I export that as an MP4 to Microsoft Stream.
So once you've uploaded that to Stream, how will students access that from Moodle, as far as you know?
I'll just upload it to my Moodle page for that particular teaching day, and they should have the link that plays the video once they click to it.
Yes. So a link to the video. And that has the advantage that it also displays the transcript, I believe, alongside.
It does, yes. It does. It's by magic. The transcript appears alongside, which is remarkable. The other thing that I'm doing is so we have on general, as generally we have hour long lecture spaces. But what I'm doing is, and we're still working with that at the moment rather than coming in and out. What I am doing though is I'm breaking my lectures into 15-minute chunks. One of the videos I saw very early on the Warwick site said two things which I have stuck with me. One was chunk it, which was a good way of putting it, and the other one was it doesn't have to be perfect. So the first one or two, or the first one, I think I was any kind of or ah, I was re-recording the slide, and I've subsequently found that I actually it makes you sound a bit more human if you have the odd and ah in there, and breaking it into bite-sized chunks is not only useful, I think, for the student, because they can sort of stop it and they get a bit of space and then they go on to the next one, but also I think it's easier in terms of handling the,
yes.
the rather than trying to upload hour-long videos that So yeah, that is one change that I have made is to break my material down into these 15 minute slots.
Oh, that sounds like a good tip, and as you say, there are a number of benefits to that. One is perhaps the students feel like they're making progress, like working through chapters or sections in a book, and then as you say, the system itself perhaps, and never mind the Wi-Fi or internet, doesn't have to struggle quite so much with such large files. That's good. Now, thanks ever so much, Alan. Is there anything in your experience going from face-to-face to being having to migrate content and working online and develop expertise that you never thought you might need? Is there anything that you've learned that you'd like to share, or anything that you wish you'd known 3 months ago?
I think I think that there's a that it does, if you're not used to it, I think that it does engender a sense of anxiety. I think that it does, because it's new. I've got, you know, 20 years of lecturing, and it's always been face-to-face and live. I think it's something new. So I think you do get that extra level of anxiety. I think I've learned is that it will do that, and that shouldn't, and you should have, and you, in a sense, you have to live with that anxiety a little bit more. But as long as you generally look for advice, ask questions, hopefully it works out in the end. So touching wood, we've only just started. Hope things will continue. We've had, well, I would say very good feedback so far. There hasn't been any issue with the first few teaching days.
Thanks, Alan. When we were chatting just now, you were talking about not forgetting the basics of teaching, as well as the importance of variety.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that you want to try. I mean, it just because you're delivering it via a different medium doesn't mean you change the content. If you know what the content is, it's finding ways of delivering that content that meet the apprentice needs, but also fit in with the means by which you're doing it. So, for example, so that idea of, I mean, you would always, naturally, you would break your, you wouldn't stand in front of somebody unless it was a formal lecture and just talk at them for an hour. So the idea that you break the recorded sessions up sort of mimics that, but you haven't necessarily got the interaction bit that you would normally have.
Sure. Thanks, Alan. So is there anything else that you'd like to say or any other advice?
I think that one of the main things is don't be afraid to ask for advice. I've rang the IT help desk on many occasion. If they can't tell me, then they usually are able to put me in touch with somebody who can. So don't feel that you have to do it all on your own. There are people that will help you, and I've had some great support from different people within the university who've given me, even if it's only I've had 10-15 minute team sessions with somebody showing me on their screen. I mean, it these little things can be really beneficial.
Definitely, don't be afraid to ask. A good tip there. Thanks, Alan. Thanks for your time. Always good to talk.
Thanks, Jim. No problem. Always happy to help. Hope the year goes well for you.
In a recent LDCU open discussion on the theme of design for online learning, Jess Humphreys and Jenny Mills shared some of their ideas and practical tips on how to involve students in co-design.
You need a plan before you even start. So you need to know what it is you're trying to do, how you're going to bring the student voice in. It's a really tricky one, but you're doing it ongoing, isn't it? It's because every time we evaluate a course, every time we get feedback, we're designing what we do next. We're responding to that. So it's quite an iterative process. But with co-design itself, it's a challenge, but it is a case of trying, and there are lots of resources available. We're here, we've got funding to help with that as well.
I think as well it's there's not just one way to do it, no. And it's not an all or nothing. So, you know, you may think, well, actually, you know, we're doing this, we're up against it, the course has got to be kind of ready to go in 2 weeks time, the students have all disappeared for the summer, how, you know, I can't even begin to think about that. But it can be about just building in spaces within the curriculum for students to bring and this will depend on discipline, obviously, as well, but leave enough spaces for students to sort of bring their input, or to sort of, you know, choose between different texts, or to go off and find an example that would illustrate the sort of theoretical principles that you want to explore in a particular week or a particular seminar. So it doesn't always have to be, you know, you're all sitting around the table before the course kicks off, although of course that's one way to do it. It can be about just building in opportunities for students to not just give feedback on the course, but to actually help build their understanding and build the, in inverted commas, content, and to create the curriculum to a certain extent.
I think that's exactly right, Jenny. And I think it's how we scaffold that learning and give them that opportunity to have that independence in their learning. And I think that's one thing that teaching online gives us an opportunity here to do just that. so that there is an opportunity to get that student engagement to help inform how it goes forward.
Academic technologist Nick Bullen from the School of Life Sciences joined the discussion and talked about some of the challenges of co-design.
I think the hardest element is the co-design of a module, really. Getting that really strong student input, because as you say, it does involve quite a considerable amount of consideration and work to some extent. And I think that it happens through the different channels, such as, you know, feedback on modules and ongoing feedback through the year, both formal and informal, through things such as, you know, student councils and things like that. But I think, as I think Jenny basically said the same, that isn't necessarily really, you know, getting into the depth of co-design, which is, I think it feels like it's another level in, really, in that you can get feedback from students and get their thoughts. But then when you start to move into trying to perhaps develop a module where the students have a really strong impact on what's studied from the very beginning of its design is a little bit harder. And I mean, even though we've got an opportunity now, it's going to have its own barriers because of the time limits that people have got to be able to produce, you know, electronic content that would have been face-to-face, and the elements perhaps that you lose in that face-to-face interaction when you're standing in a room and having an informal discussion, which of course you can use tools to work with that online.
Senior academic technologist Robert O'Toole joined us. He has a background in design thinking and a particular interest in design in general.
To a design researcher, so somebody like me from the design research world, the Design Research Society, that whole academic background, it's amusing to see how co-design in higher education, people kind of think that they've invented this for the first time, when in fact, this is something that's been going on, being developed and being deeply researched for well over 50 years. And there's lots of different strands, lots of different places that's come from, especially the Scandinavian participatory design movement, which originated in their industrial relations approach. So unions and management working in a very different way to what you expect in Britain and America. So there's this huge body of research and a pretty good understanding of how to do co-designing, how to do designing, how successful professional designers work, which is the background for the design thinking movement. So the design thinking movement, the idea there is you can take the approaches that professional designers use all the time and put them into communities. The key is to consistently develop design capability in the community. Don't expect it to just happen. You actually have to work at it. And there are four key elements. Design knowledge, which is actual, that kind of knowledge about how things are now and all of the different options. Okay, so you're going to get a group of people, maybe some students together. Students are going to have some really important insights that you're not going to have about your own design, about your own teaching. That's so important. Other people will as well. So it's always important to get all of those insights together and share them.
Students may still have lots to learn about your subject, but they can give us a perspective on what it's like to be a learner. Jenny Mills.
I just wanted to come back to that point that Rob just made about students having insight. And I think this is, I sort of think that there are different sort of scales of students getting involved in design. Some of them are quite grand and some of them are very sort of small and granular. But I think it's important to recognise that, you know, students are experts in being students. They're not necessarily experts in chemistry or history. You know, that's why they're at university. They're learning. That's why they're here. So it's not like relinquishing control and saying, you know, throwing your hands up and saying, oh, well, you know, you do it. But it's listening to them and listening to their sort of experiences of being learners, which is a very different perspective in the sort of educational relationship to what we have as sort of educators. So I think recognizing the expertise that they have, which may not be disciplinary expertise yet, but an expertise in about what they're bringing to the course is really important.
We talked a little about some of the assumptions we shouldn't make about our learners. This included not assuming that our students will all necessarily have the experience and technical skills necessary. They may need help and support, and also that not all learners will have access to the equipment and connections that we might assume they'll have to take part. Jess Humphries and Robert O'Toole discuss these ideas further.
But also, there are things we can assume, that they are all there to learn. They're all eager to engage in this, and we do need to get to know our students. We need to take that time out. One of the tricky things at the moment is how we foster that sense of community, how we build up those relationships, what our presence is in this new online world, and thinking about that in the design process as well.
Yeah, one thing that I struggle with, and I've learned a lot from watching some specific academics teaching, is the cultural differences and being sensitive to often just ways of speaking, language terms, assumptions about how people organise and get and behave, and finding ways to be much more clear about that. So, and I've seen some academics who do that in a really thoughtful way. So you can tell, they're really thinking it through how to speak to these diverse cultural groups. Yeah.
And finally, Robert O'Toole and Jenny Mills warn about the dangers of building in false assumptions into our designs.
What you're saying there about building assumptions into designing, assumptions that are wrong, that are based on a small amount of information being misinterpreted, that's a really important thing to understand, how designing can actually give you the wrong result.
I just wanted to loop back about this idea of designing over designing is the wrong phrase, I think, but sort of designing too much so that there's no flex. And I think that's really important because Gert Biester's talked about, education is not a closed system. It's not input in, it does something predictable and then outputs out. There's all sorts of complexities, it's situational. Human beings are kind of messy things and react in sort of random ways to different things. So I completely agree that actually if you assume a fixed system that you can sort of control, you're going to do yourself a disservice. So you will create a design that doesn't work because it's not able to respond.
So that's it for this first bumper edition of this podcast. Thanks again to our contributors, Mo Moini, Alan Dolan, Jess Humphries, Jenny Mills, Robert O'Toole, and Nick Bullen. And my name is Jim Judges. If you have something to share related to the world of online learning at Warwick, or know someone who does, then please do get in touch. We're keen to hear from as many different voices and colleagues from across the university, and I'd be happy to carry out an interview sometime soon. I can guarantee that it's not too painful. I should reward anyone that's made it this far with a podcast fact, and according to an Ofcom report from September last year, over 17 million people in the UK now listen to podcasts each week, and that's before they took the number of people listening to this podcast into account. Thanks for listening.